This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Most of us can't imagine ever harming a child, especially one of our own children. But as recent high-profile cases here in Cincinnati show, child abuse continues to be a tragic and ongoing problem. And from physical attacks to neglect, the abuse can take many forms. According to the Department of Health and Human Services in 2012 nationally, more than 680,000 children were considered abused or neglected, and an estimated 1,640 kids died as a result. Here to talk about child abuse and prevention and some of the mental health issues involved are Lindner Center of Hope staff psychiatrist Dr. Tracy Cummings, Sheridan Wohls, Director for Behavioral Health and Child Welfare with Beach Acres Parenting Center, Jill Gay, Director of Treatment Services with the Family Nurturing Center, and Dr. Robert Shapiro, Director of the Meyerson Center for Safe and Healthy Children Child Abuse Team at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bob, talk about just how prevalent is child abuse at the local level.
Well, really, it's a sad figure, Mark, because we see children for possible child abuse every single day in Cincinnati. In our center alone, we see 6 or 7 children because of concerns of physical, sexual abuse, and that doesn't even include the children brought into the emergency department or seen in other areas for child abuse concerns. And even worse is that this is just the tip of the iceberg. Mm. The number of children who are abused is vastly greater. In fact, we know from talking with adults that nearly 1 in 3 say that they experienced child abuse growing up. And of course, we don't see anywhere near that number. So the potential to intervene is huge. Unfortunately, recognizing when a child is abused is quite difficult.
And a lot of this must go unreported as well, I would think.
It goes unreported. Those of us in the field see that there are a number of priorities. Some of that is to create safer environments so kids don't get abused in the first place. We want families to stay together. We want to empower families so they can take care of their kids. Once abuse has happened, once we know about it, once a child's been injured, that starts off an entirely different cycle, chain of events, and the problem changes.
Jill, do you think we're getting any better at tracking child abuse and detecting it early before it gets out of hand?
I do think in recent years we have seen just an increase in most service providers being open to getting information about child abuse and neglect. For example, our Stewards of Children's program, where we go out and teach people as adults that it's their responsibility to protect children from child sexual abuse, we have seen an increase in demand for those free presentations, just so adults in any entity, whether it be a soccer coach, a school teacher, or a church or other type of social organization, has the information of how to recognize and intervene appropriately when they recognize those signs.
Tracy, what do you think? Are we getting better at discovering these cases early?
I think so. And I think what's important is for us to realize that across all demographics, we could be talking about any age, race, socioeconomic status, this can be happening in those families. So we have to be open to listening. We don't need to try to pinpoint a certain area, but to be willing to hear what these children may have to tell us, whether it's verbally or non-verbally by their actions.
Sheridan, what do you think as far as early detection? Is that getting better?
I think one thing we're really particularly trying to focus on is a lot of prevention work, because when you can get to families earlier, you might be able to see those signs that are precursors to abuse and neglect and really implement some services for them on the front end to before you even get to that point.
And Bob, what are the long-term consequences to society as a whole if child abuse is not reduced and not caught in time?
Mark, I like to answer that question by telling you a little story, a little background. And about 19 years ago, a study was done at Kaiser Permanente asking the adults in that practice to describe their childhood and describe adverse events. The study was called the Adverse Childhood Experience, or ACE study. And the doctors at Kaiser asked these patients, tell us about what it was like growing up. And they asked about 10 specific events, things that were hardships, things that were, that identified adversity. And 5 of those 10 were about child abuse and neglect. And the results were staggering because, one, they learned just how prevalent child abuse was in this employed, middle-class, educated, successful population. Really high. And number two, to answer your question, they learned that exposure to adversity during childhood has lifelong consequences. And they were seeing that their patients had more substance abuse problems. They had more suicide attempts, more mental illness. They had a host of unhealthy behaviors. And not only that, Mark, but they were dying younger. They had more heart disease. They had more lung disease, which was a little bit of a puzzle. Hmm. But for the first time, we began to get a glimpse of how child abuse affects the lifelong trajectory of individuals, and it was staggeringly horrible.
Jill, what about mental health issues for the child? I read a figure that 80% of 21-year-olds who were abused as children met criteria for at least one psychological disorder. So this is setting children on a bad path when this happens. Jill?
Hello.
Oh, you're still there.
Sorry, I think I lost you for a moment.
There we go. Glad you're back.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that we notice, and just to reference back to the ACEs study that Dr. Shapiro referenced, we do see that. And we see that when children, even if they aren't meeting that full diagnostic criteria, just the exposure to those adverse experiences does set them on a lifelong trajectory. One of the things we talk about the most is wanting kids to be safe and healthy and prepared educationally. And having these early adverse events prior to starting school really sets them on a trajectory of lifelong problems.
Sheridan, there was also there have been some studies lately that show that this actually causes changes in the brain, and maybe Tracy, you can weigh in on this as well. And if I understand this correctly, in layman's terms, that early subjection to child abuse it sets your stress system into permanent overdrive.
That's right. And a lot of the brain research shows you can look at the images of the brain and see the structural differences, and seeing how a child exposed to abuse and neglect, their brain is not as developed as a normal functioning child. The positive piece in that is that your brain can be rebuilt.
It's true. So the cortical area, so the outside area, has even shown some thinning on imaging that can be seen. And it's thought that perhaps at some point in time that's providing a bit of protection for those children if they're receiving ongoing assaults towards them, as almost a dulling of feeling the emotion involved in that. But it's true, as Sheridan just mentioned, that because we can start to intervene early, we can make those changes, similar to changes we may see in someone who's experienced trauma in adulthood. You can see imaging differences compared to normals, but that you can work on that through therapy, through interventions, through support with the family, and things can certainly get better. It's amazing how resilient some of these children can be.
Okay. 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And Bob, child abuse takes a lot of different forms, doesn't it? I mean, we usually think of the physical attack on a child, beating a child, but there are a lot of different ways that child abuse can manifest.
Absolutely. And traditionally, we've divided into physical child abuse, sexual child abuse, neglect, and some other weirder forms of child abuse, like when a parent pretends that a child is sick and isn't. We call that medical child abuse. And one of the things that I've learned over the years, Mark, is that although as a physician, I need to diagnose each of those forms of abuse differently and I need to treat them differently, what they all have in common is how it affects the child's perception of the world around them and how it affects that child's future growth. And these brain changes we were just talking about is likely common to all forms of maltreatment. And in fact, probably not all that different to other causes of stress. And so here we're talking about food insecurity, where kids don't have enough to eat or don't know where the next meal is coming from. Poverty, where they don't have adequate housing, where they don't have secure or safe housing, where the parents are struggling to put a roof over their heads, put a meal on the table, as well as try somewhere further down, probably on a priority list, help them with schoolwork. And these two have these same consequences for children in our community. So when we look at what can we do to prevent the effects of child abuse, I translate that or change that a little bit to saying, what can we do to help Cincinnati's children grow up healthier, better prepared for school, more likely to succeed in life? And not only helping to abolish child abuse and maltreatment, but equally along with that goes to supporting families in Cincinnati so that they have healthy environments in which to grow and develop. It's all important.
I think that's a good point because as we were starting to talk about earlier, there are vast societal benefits to curbing child abuse.
So there are, and we're all struggling. We have some fantastic initiatives in place in Cincinnati. Success by Six, Preschool Promise, Every Child Succeeds. What each of these programs wants to do, and I'm leaving some out and I apologize, but what each of these programs want to do is help children succeed into adulthood to realize their full potential. And this is something that we can do together. So the Mayerson Center at Cincinnati Children's and the Family Nurturing Center in Beach Acres work to help families struggling with child abuse and neglect. But the sad truth is we're not going to stop child abuse in its entirety. We've learned, though, that this is all a dose-related effect. In other words, the more adversity, the more abuse, the more negative influences a child has, these tend to pile up one after another. And at some point, it becomes too much for any child to bear. And so if we can reduce these adversities, if we can help Cincinnati raise healthier families, support families, we're going to get ahead of this. And that's, I think, a helpful way to think about this battle.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Jill, do you think that verbal and emotional abuse is just as detrimental as physical abuse?
I think in my experience, we have seen situations where children's experiences of a variety of abuse impact them differently and uniquely based on the child. And as Dr. Shapiro was mentioning, the overriding layering of each of those adverse experiences. So it's hard to just pinpoint what is worse and what is not. But I think it's the child's experience as well as what was the person's response when they first told. We find a lot of times that the younger a child is, if they tell someone that something's happening to them or they disclose that, they kind of dip their toe in the water of disclosing, so to speak. How that person responds when that child discloses can have a significant impact on whether the child feels safe and protected or whether they kind of close back up and stop telling. So we know those are important factors that really impact the devastating effects that any type of abuse can have on a child.
We will continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and we're talking about child abuse and prevention and some of the mental health issues involved with Lindner Center of Hope staff psychiatrist Dr. Tracy Cummings, Sheridan Wohls, Director for Behavioral Health and Child Welfare with Beach Acres Parenting Center, Jill Gay, Director of Treatment Services with the Family Nurturing Center, and Dr. Robert Shapiro, Director of the Mayerson Center for Safe and Healthy Children Child Abuse Team at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. And what ideas do you have? What do you think would be a good way to make Cincinnati a safer place for kids and to reduce child abuse? Give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, what are some of the contributing factors to child abuse from your experience as Sheridan and Tracy? What are some of the things that are leading to this? We know mental health issues are one. What are some of the other areas that we need to deal with?
In our experience with families, we've seen it's really when stress levels get unmanageable. So we've worked with families to work on their stress management prior to things really getting toxic.
Tracy?
So some risk factors, whenever there's maybe caregiver burden, so whether if that child has some special needs, whether it's mental health or physical health that requires more care and patience by the parent, there's a certain risk there. Also, we know if there's a history of maltreatment in the parent, there's some risk that things may occur. You mentioned the mental health components, and that can be across the board. If a parent is struggling with depression, perhaps they don't have the motivation or the ability to care care for themselves, which will then convey over to how they're able to care for the child, versus, say, if we have someone who has a substance abuse problem, they may not be able to think clearly and make rational decisions. So it can go across the board there. We also know social situations can be a problem. If it's an isolated family, if it's a society that there's a high violence area, there are some risk factors there.
Jill, can you talk some more about how mental health issues contribute to child abuse?
Sure. Many times what we see are just parents through their own symptomology. Sometimes when we're struggling with mental health symptoms, be that depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, maybe we ourselves as parents have post-traumatic stress disorder, those symptoms of those disorders become so loud in our head that it keeps us from being able to manage the day-to-day tasks of working or supporting our families or really parenting. Parenting in and of itself is a stressor when you have everything in place for you to support you. You have steady income and a safe, stable place to live and lots of family support. So if you imagine taking those same day-to-day stressors of just day-to-day normal parenting and adding to that trying to manage your own symptoms of depression where you don't feel like you can get out of bed or you don't feel like you're worthy enough of feeling the support from other people, then that exacerbates how you're going to respond to that child. Children need to be parented, and children have needs that have to be met by their parent, but those needs put pressure on a parent who's already struggling with those mental health symptoms, and it creates for a toxic environment at times.
So we're talking about stress on a caregiver, as Tracy was going into. What about the issue of losing control? You know, you hear about a parent who they're having a bad night. The child's crying in the other room. The child won't go to sleep, so they go in, and before you know it, they've either injured that child or perhaps even worse, killed them because they're frustrated and they've lost control. How do you get parents beyond that? How do you help them overcome that reaction?
You know, I think part of the prevention work that we work with families is having a plan beforehand, because when you get in the moment, you need something to be able to fall back on. You need to give yourself permission to take a time out from that situation, to be able to walk away.
Take a deep breath.
And take a deep breath. Yeah. And to know that your child, they're crying, they'll be okay for you to walk away for a few minutes and collect yourself.
Tracy?
Absolutely. So if you've established that safety is in place for that child, you can remove yourself from the situation. Obviously, if we're talking about a very small child, making sure that they are not being unsupervised for too long period of time. But knowing your temperament is going to be important as a parent. Parenting styles is also an important thing to know how you interact with that child and what will work best for your family. I think there's a lot of resources out there, too, that can be valuable. For example, the National Alliance of Mental Illness, or NAMI, does a lot of family-to-family work. And I think that can help a lot of families if they're struggling, because they can see, oh, we're not the only ones here. And then it's one thing to read in a book or online, you know, it tells me to do X, Y, and Z. But now if I'm having this actual conversation with another family that's been there, now I can get it. And now I feel like I have some hope.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk with John in Northern Kentucky. Good afternoon, John. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you for taking my call. Here's my question. I'll just make it personal. My grandson, who's now 14, when he was around 12, started with anorexia. He was treated locally, and he was treated at the Lindner Center, and this went on for about a year or so. He was even sent up to some place, I think, in Milwaukee. This time last year, or about the early last year, he informed his therapist that he had been raped, sexually abused by his grandfather, me. Now, I didn't do it. So the short of it is, my concern is the family doesn't speak to me. I've not had any interaction with any health professionals, legal people, or anything like that. My concern is if a young boy is has been sexually abused or has some traumatic thing happen, and my therapist, I was going to therapy, said sometimes a boy will mention, or a person, boy or girl, will say that they'll mention someone did it who they really trust and knows would never hurt them, as opposed to the actual abuser who has threatened physical harm. I don't know if that's the case. My concern is he is being treated for the past year on the assumption that his grandfather did this horrible crime to him, when in fact, at least I didn't do it. And I don't know how and if that's even a concern that... So I'll shut up and see what y'all have to say about that.
Okay, thank you for the call, John.
Well, I appreciate you calling in. That was probably difficult for you to do, so I appreciate you doing that. I guess I don't know that I can speak directly to your absolute situation, but I would say that in a lot of situations, you will hear this, where maybe something happened to a child a long time in the past, and they are not able to disclose something until much later. And that could be for a variety of factors, but also, so if we're thinking about when someone was very young, perhaps recall of that event may not be perfect. And there's also, we know working with children, there's a lot about perception, what someone may perceive as a traumatic or a maltreatment or abusive event may not be what, you know, the adult would have described as maltreatment or abuse. And it sounds to me like I'm still hearing support in your voice, that you still care very much about this child, and that's important to hear, and that this child's also receiving treatment for symptoms they are describing, and that's what's going to propel this person forward and to be able to have everyone move forward successfully. But I am sorry to hear that it's an ongoing struggle in your family. We certainly want children to feel that they can open up and have someone listen to them without their causing a divide. That can be really hard for kids. A lot of times they don't tell because they don't want to divide their family and have people choose sides. So it sounds like this has been really difficult. So thank you.
Tracy, you mentioned trauma. Do the victims often go through post-traumatic stress disorder? Is that what happens a lot of times?
Well, actually, it's impressive because a lot of people can withstand many things and not develop, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. And that sort of comes back to that resiliency. But you can see some of those symptoms. So whether it's a disturbance in sleep, maybe nightmares or a recall of the event throughout the day, maybe they're trying to do their homework or listen, but these flashbacks come back into mind. But it may not come together as a full diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, but that's things you definitely want to look for.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And let's talk to Steve in Clifton. Good afternoon, Steve. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you. I had a couple questions, but the main one is, I have seen sometimes where maybe a police officer or someone in authority, possibly judges, and they get kids and situations, you know, I mean, maybe the kid did something, maybe they didn't. But then the police or some government type authority or some official type authority, you know, maybe does something to the kids. It's more or less mental or maybe physical, maybe they lock them up. Has there been any studies, number one, on those kind of things? And another thing that comes to mind is, like, when kids get sexually abused and the police are called in, sometimes the police would ask, you know, just like with the rape victims or the older females, well, what did you do, or why didn't you fight, or something like that? And they don't seem to take us serious. How do you think that may affect the victims?
Okay, thanks for the question, Steve.
One of the things that you're describing is first responder response, and when the police or other first responders hear concerns about child abuse, how should they respond so that they don't cause new trauma to the child? How are they supportive to the child? And then go, what are the next steps so that an investigation can be done? And that's a really important question that you're asking. There's a term for that. It's called a trauma-informed response, and you can read more about that if you're curious. But you've hit on some of the important components of that, which include not blaming the victim, listening carefully, providing a supportive environment, making sure that there is safety so that if abuse has occurred, it doesn't occur again, and then you go from there.
Bob, who is doing the abuse? Is it strangers, or is it typically someone that the child knows who is the abuser?
Well, child abuse occurs in young children by an individual has access to that child. And so young children typically are only around adults who have some position of authority and responsibility. So, of course, parents have the most time with children, and it turns out that parents do an awful lot of the abusing. But abuse, particularly sexual abuse, can occur in any environment. And of course, we're all aware, if we're keeping up with the news, about the abuse that occurs in religious institutions and in Boy Scouts and in camps and in schools. Virtually anywhere where an adult has access to a child is vulnerable.
Now, I've heard that children who become victims of abuse and neglect, it can start as early as 18 months. Is that right?
Well, we have seen young infants who have been sexually assaulted.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had to pause with that one, don't you?
Yeah, that's just terrifying to even think about.
Yeah, it is to us too. And even though we see this, we don't ever get used to it.
Doesn't ever get any easier to see, does it? Are there typical general characteristics that abusive adults might share?
Gosh, that's a hard question.
And Jill, if you have any insight on this, you can weigh in too. So,
you know, when you're talking about sexual abuse, Mark, I have to tell you that I have never understood this.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, in my line of work, I'm taking care of the kids, and I'm not trying to understand what was going on in the minds of the adults.
So what about you? Are there general characteristics that abusive adults might share?
You know, I think that is, again, a difficult question to answer, because it's almost unfathomable for us to understand what goes on. I think there, you know, some research to support that there are some common characteristics amongst abusers, but it's really difficult to pinpoint and really put a finger on, because the temptation is we want to understand so we can figure them out when we run into them in the grocery store, or we run into them in our line of work, or we run into them in our children's school. And I think it's dangerous if we just assume all people who abuse children look like a certain type, because it keeps us from thinking that through and watching for patterns of behavior. And really, we just want to minimize the risk to children, and really working through this prevention services to help people start to recognize when something doesn't seem right. You know, why is the music teacher taking my child to the back hallway with a closed door and teaching their music lessons? Can't there be a window put in the door? Can't there be some steps as a parent that I recognize to help protect my child? And so I think it's really dangerous just to start putting a finger on what an abuser of a child looks like.
And Mark, we talked earlier about parenting, and I wouldn't mind getting back to that, because parenting is really difficult. And mm-hmm. anyone who's listening to the show who has children know that it's really stressful. And so if you have two sets of parents who are emotionally stable and they don't have a lot of stress in their lives, so adding children to that mix probably adds a level of stress that's manageable. When you start adding other environmental stresses, the likelihood that that family can remain intact and provide a nurturing environment for the child decreases. And yet, I think that there's a pervasive feeling that we shouldn't have to ask about how to parent. We should know how to take care of children. And this is a barrier, because we have some effective interventions. We have some really nice ways to help parents get through some of these sticky problems with kids. But many parents are reluctant to ask for help because it might be seen as a failure, and they're supposed to know how to do this. And boy, this is a problem we haven't licked, and maybe some callers have got some suggestions. How do we destigmatize parenting help?
And Bob, I really appreciate you bringing that up. I think when you first have a child, you go through classes for the birthing process. You work with a lactation consultant afterwards if you're breastfeeding. But then when does that end? And when is it no longer acceptable to ask for help as a parent? And so with Beach Acres Parenting Center, those are the areas where we love to get involved with families. We love to be able to coach you through those situations, because families are tremendously resilient. If you have the support system, if you have someone who can help you navigate those simple life things that may not seem so simple at any given moment. How do we help them overcome those life's trials in a way that then generalizes and they can use those skills throughout their child's life?
We will continue our conversation after this, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guests this afternoon are Lindner Center of Hope staff psychiatrist Dr. Tracy Cummings, Sheridan Wolves, Director for Behavioral Health and Child Welfare with Beekchakers Parenting Center, Jill Gay, Director of Treatment Services with the Family Nurturing Center, and Dr. Robert Shapiro, Director of the Meyerson Center for Safe and Healthy Children Child Abuse Team at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Sandra and Oakley. Good afternoon, Sandra. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you. I would like to hear some comments about relations with young teens or preteens, and whether experimentation that goes too far has the same kind of damaging effect as like a child who's taken advantage of by a trusted adult. We've had a situation in our family that where the adults have decided that it's very damaging to the children, and I don't know whether it just was a flirtation between kids that got a little bit too far, or whether there is potential damage when young people a few years apart, maybe get into a little bit of trouble with experimenting.
Jill, you want to comment on that?
Sure. I think that, and thank you, that's a very, very good question to ask. And I think what we want to start to consider is the power differential in the relationship. There is some normal sexual development that goes throughout toddler through adulthood, and those are things that are appropriate and experimental type behavior. But we also have to take a look at those interactions and those relationships and recognize that at certain points in time, a shift in power differential may occur, and there is the potential for harm and a potential for abuse. We have seen a vast number of children coming through our TikTok program, which is specifically for victims of child sexual abuse, where the people who are abusing those children are older siblings or older relatives or older kids in the community. And so we do know and recognize that children can have the potential to harm other children. But the important piece to look at is that power differential and the actual acts that were taking place.
And I think even if the parents have any concerns that perhaps this was damaging to their child or could be damaging to their child, going ahead and setting up services to provide them with an opportunity to speak about this is not going to cause damage.
Absolutely.
And John called. He wanted to know, does being sexually abused as a child make that child more likely to be an abuser as an adult? Bob, do you have any thought on that?
Not necessarily. There is a popular thought that when children are abused, they become abusive parents. And there's some increased risk to that. But just because an individual is sexually abused doesn't mean that they can't become healthy and provide a nurturing environment for their children.
It goes back, Tracy, I think, what you were saying about resiliency.
Mm-hmm. It's true. We do know that sometimes individuals who were abused as children have a difficult time engaging in really good adult relationships, whether that be with work or with intimacy. But it does not mean that it has to be the case.
Sheridan, child abuse is such a grim thing, and it seems like it's a never-ending struggle. Do you think we're making any progress?
I think as a community, we really are working together to make sure that we're raising the awareness. So programs just like we're having today, making sure that this is something that's not in the seedy underworld of our city. This is something that really, truly can impact all of us. It's everyone's responsibility to make sure that our communities are safe and we have nurturing environments for our children. You know, just looking at my organization alone, we've served over 23,000 children and adults last year. So when you combine all of us together throughout the city, I think we're making quite an impact. But there's much more to be done.
Tracy?
I think sometimes people, too, hesitate to report a suspicion of some child maltreatment. And I think what the disservice of that is that sometimes then those families can't receive the services that would benefit them and see some success in the family. So I don't think people should view this such as, oh, no, you know, I'm going to cause a problem in this family or I don't want to get involved. You may think of it as I'm going to get involved so that this child can go on and do well.
Jill, what are your thoughts? Are we making progress in the fight against child abuse?
I do think we are. I think that just as we've been speaking today, families are resilient and children are resilient. And the work that we are doing together as a community, both in the greater Cincinnati area and northern Kentucky, just in the collaborative effort amongst agencies. So when we find things that are working or we're collaborating on the shared services for a family, we can put the most power behind those services to have the greatest impact. Plus all the work that we as a culture here in the greater Cincinnati area are doing to really get that message out and destigmatize the topic and be able to just openly discuss when there are concerns, being willing to have those courageous conversations, not only at our jobs, but also with our own families. Many times culturally, we grow up in families where things aren't appropriate to talk about or you don't share your business with everyone. But unfortunately, harming children and the risk factors that come into play when we look at child abuse are things that we as a culture have to begin and continue to talk about to keep everyone safe.
Bob, what are your thoughts? How do we reduce this more? Is it just a matter of persistence?
We have to chip away piece by piece, and we are doing that. And nationally as well, the statistics show that fewer children are being abused than they were before. So we can be proud of that. We can also recognize that we have a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm. What would be some key suggestions that you would make for reducing this?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion here already about how different agencies and different sectors within the community are working together. And I believe I too believe that's really critical and the way to go about moving forward. One of the things that the Mayerson Center is doing at Cincinnati Children's is helping to raise awareness as well as capacity for pediatricians during well-child visits to start asking about some of these questions and to move forward to implement help for that family so that abuse is less likely to occur. And there are also some widespread initiatives. Another thing that the Mayerson Center is doing is a new initiative called Joining Forces for Children, where we are raising awareness of the effects of childhood adversity and understanding how we might become more trauma-informed as a community to reduce the stress levels on families.
Thanks to all of you for joining us this afternoon. Lerner Center of Hope staff psychiatrist Dr. Tracy Cummings, Sheridan Wohls, Director for Behavioral Health and Child Welfare with Beach Acres Parenting Center, Jill Gay, Director of Treatment Services with the Family Nurturing Center, and Dr. Robert Shapiro, Director of the Mayerson Center for Safe and Healthy Children Child Abuse Team at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center.